From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's Friday night, and we're joined by the American folk music legend, Pete Seeger. If I had a hammer, I'd have a rhythm on. For 60 years, singer, songwriter, folklorist, environmental activist, and peace advocate Pete Seeger has been wielding his hammer, a banjo, and his voice morning, noon, and night. If you've sung We Shall Overcome, Guantanamera, or Where Have All the Flowers Gone, you've walked in the folk music trail that Pete Seeger cleared and popularized. As a young man in the 1930s, he thrilled to folk, to labor, and to the power of the people. In the 50s, he was blacklisted and narrowly escaped prison. In the 60s, he became an American icon, singing clear, simple truth to power, delivering the soundtrack and the campfire songs of a nation's dreams of peace and justice. Now, 84, Pete Seeger is still singing, still nurturing the clear streams of song he spotted years ago as wellsprings of human hope, even in dark times.
Near my home in the Hudson Valley, there's a brook like this. Crystal clear. I can't say as much for the Hudson River. In a manner of speaking, there are little clear streams of music like this all through our country and probably throughout the world. And sometimes the larger streams get kind of polluted, but these little streams are still there.
Pete Seeger has just released his first single for airplay in 30 years, a song called Take It from Dr. King. We'll hear that song tonight, but first it's my pleasure and honor to welcome the man who wrote the songs my mother sang to me. Good evening and welcome, Pete Seeger.
Well, welcome, Tom Ashbrook. I'm looking forward to seeing what I can learn from you, because you must listen to hundreds and thousands of different records through the year.
Well, we hear a lot, but I can speak straight from the heart when I say, and I'm sure for many of my listeners, it's songs that you wrote, songs that you brought to the country, which were truly an enormous part of my childhood, sitting around campfires and summer camps and with the folks on the front porch or the back porch. And to tell you the God's honest truth, until I went through the whole list for this show, even after all this time, I didn't realize how much of that work was yours, Pete Seeger.
Well, I look upon myself as a link in a long chain of people who like to make music, and let's hope there's many links to come. I was at a friend's house just last night rehearsing, and she was listening to Michael Row the Boat Ashore, and
yeah.
I realized I was one of the links that brought that song around. A friend of mine found it in an old songbook published in 1867.
All right.
Taught it to me, and I put it on a record. Next thing you know, summer campers all over the country were singing it.
Oh, I must have sung it 500 times. It really did frame a whole era, and I want to talk about the spirit that so much of that music captured tonight, how it lined up with the decades you've lived through, how it lines up with our times now. But I don't want to in any way ignore the song you've just come out with and trace its root back to your relationship with Dr. King and We Shall Overcome. You've got a brand new song, Pete Seeger, at 84, called Take It from Dr. King. Tell us about the song.
Well, right after the terrible bombing at September 11th, some ideas occurred to me for a chorus. It's a very jazzy, syncopated little chorus. I played the tune on the banjo and didn't know what the heck to do with it, and all of a sudden I had words. Then I had the trouble of trying to make up verses that were not too teachy-breechy and told some kind of a story. It took me about 6 months.
No kidding.
Yeah, and finally, the third graders in my hometown sang it, and it worked out well with them. I've sung it in other places since then and finally put it in Sing Out magazine so that other people could learn it. And let's hope this record now will be heard.
Well, I'm sure it will. It's coming out on CD. Let's listen to a little bit of Pete Seeger's brand new song, Take It from Dr. King.
Down in Alabama, 1955, not many of us care today were then alive. a young Baptist preacher led a bus boycott. He showed the way for a brand new day without firing a shot.
Don't say it can't be done. The band's just begun. Take it for Dr. King. You too can learn to sing. So drop the gun.
You can sing it with us.
Don't say it can't be done. The band's just begun. Take it for Dr. King. You too can learn to sing. So drop the gun.
Pete Seeger, this song instantly catches one facet of what I see in all of your work, which is you're not trying to impress us with great complexity. You're trying to bring us a straightforward message.
Well, this is what I learned from Woody Guthrie, the fellow who wrote This Land Is Your Land. He had the genius of simplicity. One of his children's songs, he made up for his own kid when she was about 3 years old or 2 years old. Put your finger in the air, in the air. Put your finger in the air, in the air. Put your finger in the air. Hold it up right there. Put your finger in the air, in the air. You can't say, what? What on earth do you mean that's a song? Second verse is put your finger on your nose. That's where the cold wind blows.
But when you put a finger in the air, there's a lot you can feel if you pay attention.
Well, I've never failed to get a crowd of little kids putting their finger up in the air. Then put the finger on the nose, put the finger on the chin, that's where the food slips in. And I now believe that if there's a human race here in 100 years, this will be translated into, Lord knows, Swahili and Chinese and other places, just because it's a fun song to teach your child.
Talk to us about your new song. The refrain is, you too can learn to sing, so drop the gun. You refer specifically to September 11th. You say, since September 11th, many wonder, will this world survive? But if the world learns the lessons from Dr. King, we can survive. We can, we will. And so we sing, drop the gun. That's a simple phrase. Give us the full meaning.
Well, you know, a song is not a speech, and I often think of a song as a basketball backboard, and it bounces back different meanings as the experiences of your life bounce against it. I feel that I learned a tremendous amount from Dr. King. I was 36 years old when the bus boycott was started, and the fact that he didn't, some people say, why didn't you tackle something important like voting or schools or health or jobs or housing? Why do you start with the bus boycott?
Mm-hmm.
I decided that this is a very important political lesson. When you face an opponent over a broad field, you don't pick out the opponent's strong points. You try and take over some little weak point on the edge somewhere, but you take it over. You don't just make an attempt to take it over. And holding the African-American people of Montgomery together for 13 months was real genius. King had to bring the cautious conservative ones together with the angry radical ones and say, if we don't stick together, we will not win. Sometimes he'd stop right in the middle of something and say, let's take a whole day to discuss this, or 2 days if necessary, till we can agree on what our program should be.
But let's be together. And Pete Seeger, you brought to Martin Luther King the song that became the anthem of his movement that still stands for that movement, that era today, We Shall Overcome. Tell us where this song came from and how it came to be the anthem, how it came to Martin Luther King's attention.
Well, there's an old gospel song, probably made up back in the 19th century, which has one verse in it called I'll Overcome Someday. Mm. It's usually sung as I'll be all right. I'll be all right. I'll be all right someday. And another verse would be, I'll wear the crown, I'll be like him.
Right.
But one verse says, I'll overcome someday. Now, way back, almost a century ago, maybe more than a century, they turned it into a union song as We Will Overcome. I've seen a copy of a United Mine Workers Journal of 1908 saying, last year at our meetings, we started each meeting with a prayer and then singing that good old union song, We Will Overcome.
So how did it go? How did it make the leap then through your hands from that to Martin Luther King's ears?
Well, in 1946, a group of tobacco workers, about 300 women, were working for the American Tobacco Company in Charleston, South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
It was wintertime, and they were on the strike. And on the picket line, they'd keep their spirits up by singing hymns. And one woman, Lucille Simmons was her name, liked to sing this very slowly. Maybe she's the one who introduced it slowly. And a white woman, a union organizer, learned it from her and taught it to me.
Uh-huh.
And other people learned it from this white woman. Her name was Zilphia Horton. She's dead now. Had a beautiful alto voice. And a man named Guy Carawan is actually the man who introduced it to the civil rights movement. He was working in Tennessee. They had a workshop called Singing in the Movement. And people were there from Texas and Florida and Virginia and all around. They sang fast songs and slow songs and new songs and old songs. And somewhere along the line, he taught them, We Shall Overcome.
We shall live in peace.
We shall live.
What did Dr. King think of this song when he heard it?
Actually, he'd heard it 3 years before when I sang it someplace he was speaking. And a friend of mine drove him to a speaking engagement the following night. And she remembers him sitting in the back seat saying, We Shall Overcome. That song really sticks with you, doesn't it? But he wasn't a song leader. It was my friend Guy Carawan who taught it to 70 or 80 young people. And they... A month later, at Raleigh, North Carolina, they had the founding convention of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC for short.
Yep.
And somebody shouted out, Guy, teach us all, we shall overcome. Well, a month later, it was all around the country, and they worked out a way of crossing their hands in front of their bodies, so your left hand grasped the right hand of the person to your right, and your right hand grasped the hand of the left hand of the person to your left. So your shoulders touch and you sway slightly back and forth while you're singing.
We've all seen it. Pete Seeger, we've got to take a short break.
Sure.
But there's the story, folks, of a song that's become practically a national anthem. Let's go into the break, listening to Pete Seeger singing We Shall Overcome. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
from Boston University. This is...
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the father of American folk music, Pete Seeger. Let's listen to Pete Seeger performing Waist Deep in the Big Muddy.
It was back in 1942, I was a member of a good platoon. We were on maneuvers in Louisiana one night by the light of the moon. The captain told us to ford a river, that's how it all begun. We were knee-deep in the big muddy, the big fool said to push on. Well, the sergeant said, sir, are you sure this is the best way back to the base? Sergeant, go on, I forded this river about a mile above this place. It'll be a little soggy, but just keep slogging, we'll soon be on dry ground. We were waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool said to push on. Well, the sergeant said, sir, with all this equipment, no man will be able to swim. Sergeant, don't be a nervous Nelly, the captain said to him. All we need is a little determination, men follow me, I'll lead on. We were neck deep in the big muddy, the big fool said to push on.
Pete Seeger, there you are with a song that, from everything I read, was written in anger. It's written about war, it's written about World War II, but in protest of Lyndon Baines Johnson's war in Vietnam. Can you take us back to when you wrote that song and what moved you to write it?
Well, let me say first that I think it's a great tragedy that Johnson found himself in this situation. He didn't know how to get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the better presidents we've had. In 1965, it was he who got on the radio and said, not only Negroes in the South, but all of us in America will benefit by getting rid of this legacy of oppression and injustice, and we shall overcome.
Picking up that refrain, even in his speech, and we grant him that big picture. But at this moment in history, with Iraq looming, we're interested in politics and war.
Well, way back in 1954, I remember reading when the French were being kicked out of Vietnam by the Viet Cong, I remember reading that, well, USA is going to move in there because we need the tungsten. Tungsten you can find in Vietnam and China, which at that time was now a communist country. So
a metal critical in fighter jets and all kinds of armaments.
That's right. Well, things, step by step by step over the decade, it got worse and worse. And I had first tried making up a story song out of a letter in my local newspaper. A woman said, dear editor, what's our country coming to? My husband wrote me a letter from Vietnam a month ago, said it's my own troops I have to watch out for. I sleep with a pistol under my head. Mm. We've got a few generals on our side, but they just want our guns. Mm. Last week, my husband was killed, and his casket came home today. Well, I turned it into a song. He said, we've no friends here, no hardly a one. We've got a few generals who just want our guns. Mm. However, it wasn't a song people could join in on, and I always liked a song that has some kind of a refrain.
It's a Pete Seeger trademark.
And I tried making a song, if you love your Uncle Sam, bring him home, support our boys in Vietnam, bring him home. But it was too teachy-preachy. It was more of an editorial in rhyme, which is a dangerous thing for a songwriter. You want to tell a story or paint a picture in some way. All of a sudden, I got a phrase. One whole line appeared, the tune and the words all at once. Waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Mm. I saw a photograph in a newspaper of American troops wading across the Mekong with life jackets, holding guns high, and I knew it was a good idea. I get about 20 ideas for songs for every one I finish.
Yeah.
And usually write 20 full songs for every one that somebody else finds worth singing. But this took me about 2 weeks, and I got it finished, and by gosh, was able to sing it on the Smothers Brothers comedy show.
Just barely. The network tried to get you off or keep you off.
Actually, the first time I did it, they scissored my song out of the tape. And the Smothers Brothers took their complaints to the print media, and by gosh, the whole country knew that the song had been censored. So finally, 3 months later, I think it was January 1948, Columbia's broadcasting system, okay, you can have them sing the song. And I flew out to the West Coast and sang it along with a batch of other songs. I think I sang Yankee Doodle and John Brown's Body and my favorite song of all time by soldiers. It's called The D-Day Dodgers, written by British soldiers in Italy. Hilariously funny in one in the beginning and then deeply tragic in the end.
As so many songs of peace are, and Pete Seeger, you've written and sung so many. Americans are right now grappling with Iraq. A lot of confusion about where to stand on it. Some are standing up to protest. Song has always been a part of war protest. You arranged a song called How Can I Keep From Singing? I want to listen to just a bit of that and then sure. Get your thoughts on war protest.
My life flows on in endless song, above earth's lamentation I hear the real, though far off, him that hails a new creation. Through all the tumult and the strife, I hear that music ringing. It sounds an echo in my soul. How can I keep from singing? What though the tempest round me roars, I know the truth, it liveth. What though
Pete Seeger singing How Can I Keep From Singing?
You should listen to Enya's record, the Irish singer.
Yes.
He sold 6 million copies of a recording of that song.
You did her a big favor, and she your song a big honor, I guess.
The song was written around 1850 or 1855. And at the time I recorded it, I didn't know it was written by a woman who lived only 6 miles from where I live today, on a little island across from West Point in the Hudson River. The woman who taught it to me was from the Deep South. Well, not too deep. She was from North Carolina.
Yeah.
And she taught it to me, said that this was my grandmother's favorite song. And she taught it to me. She didn't tell me that she'd made up the great third verse. When tyrants tremble sick with fear and hear their death knells ringing, when friends rejoice both far and near, how can I keep from singing?
How can I keep from singing? In prison cell and dungeon vile, our thoughts to them are winging. When friends by shame are undefiled, how can I keep from singing?
Here, once again, I'm very glad to have been a link in a chain to bring this song back.
Pete Seeger, bring that chain forward with us. Look forward down the chain, if you can imagine. In the 60s, when you were singing this song, Vietnam was the war. Now, here we are. It's a new century, and we have a potential new war in front of us. We love your music, but we know you're a thinker as well. Could you have imagined then that the U.S. would be in this kind of world-straddling military power projection position today? Is this just fundamental to what we are, or did you have a different dream?
America's a mixed-up nation, of course, as you know. And as Nixon once said, it's a nation of vociferous minorities and silent majorities. mm-hmm. But I honestly do believe that if there's a human race here in 100 years, we're going to learn from these disasters and learn that in the long run, King was right, that we are going to be able to survive if we can learn ways to cool it. Now, how to cool things in Iraq, I won't say an exact prescription, but for one thing, you know, there's a lot of ways you can influence people without using guns. Mm-hmm. And yet we our government does it all the time. Way back when Clinton was president, they sent guided missiles from a warship in the Red Sea to pinpoint targets in Kabul, Afghanistan, and Khartoum in the Sudan, Africa. Mm-hmm. Well, it was a miracle of technology, but when they got there, it was one more piece of military stupidity. They dropped some bombs. What they could have done would drop leaflets, maybe with pictures on it for people who can't read too well, showing them what their own stupid male leaders are doing. Mm-hmm. And I honestly believe this is what should have been done when Hitler took over Germany. You see, the first country that a dictator conquers is his own country. Mm-hmm. And when Hitler closed down on freedom of speech and freedom of the press, I think the rest of the world ought to send into the German people leaflets of some sort, letting them know how Hitler started and what he was really up to.
So don't give up on the conversation. Never give up on the dialogue.
Yeah. Incidentally, speaking of Hitler, I was in Latin America in Nicaragua and read a poem in Spanish. Now, I don't know Spanish well enough to remember the Spanish, but I remember the translation. And the name of the poem was The Young Art Student. And the first line says, the young art student was painting what he was sure would be his masterpiece. Brushstroke after brushstroke, he knew it was going to win a prize. No, it did not win a prize. It didn't even get honorable mention. In fact, he heard through the grapevine the judges had laughed at it. The young art student gritted his teeth, clenched his hands till the nails bit into his palms. He said, someday those people will pay for this. And 30 years later, 6 million died.
Pete Seeger, I want to ask you a favor. We are in the 21st century now. You've lived a life that's been blessed with many years, and it goes back deep into the 20th century, into a time that many of our listeners have no experience of, can scarcely imagine, the 30s and 40s when you were growing up and knew well and very active. Give us your nutshell bio to convey to a young listener's ears today the course of a life like yours in a century that they will little know.
Well, first of all, the 1920s were prosperous. They said if you had $25 and could afford a piece of stock, it would double itself in 2 years.
So there's an echo we know there.
And then in 1929, the whole thing crashed. I remember before that, though, I was as dumb as any young person. In our little school, we had a kind of a mock election in 1928, and I wanted to be like everybody else. I didn't want to stand out like a sore thumb. I said, who's everybody voting for? And they said, oh, we're voting for Hoover. So I voted for Hoover. Later on, I found out my roommate had voted for a guy named Norman Thomas. I said, who's he? I thought the election was between Hoover and Smith. Oh, Norman Thomas is a socialist, doesn't get many votes. But Well, later on, I learned I ran a school newspaper from about age 12, and then in another school, I got a scholarship there by running it. And later on in college, I helped run a little journal.
And you had heroes who were journalists, muckrakers, and the editor of the New Masses, the official newspaper of the Communist Party in the U.S., Mike Gold.
I was a closet lefty. But it was understandable in those days when Hitler really got going. Mm-hmm. The question was what to do about it. Now, some people were strict pacifists. I have pacifists in my family. Mm-hmm. But I didn't agree with them. I said, somebody's got to stop Hitler in some way. I spent 3.5 years in World War II, mm-hmm. went out to the island of Saipan. But the joke is, you know, yeah. Other people got shot up and everything. What did I do in World War II? I played the banjo.
And you had become very good by the time of World War II. Woody Guthrie was part of your inspiration. You'd seen Lead Belly and seen a lot of the real folk music roots of America. By the 40s, you were singing with the Weavers and making a splash.
That was quite unexpected. Lee Hayes, who was the son of an Arkansas preacher, had taught me songs like Saints Go Marching In and Amazing Grace, and they really needed a group to sing them right. And we knew a couple other people who were good singers. Ronnie Gilbert had a glorious alto voice, and Fred Halliman, a good baritone. So we put together a little group, but we were about to break up because we didn't get any jobs until finally I got a job in a small nightclub in Greenwich Village. Believe it or not, our salary was $200 a week for all four of us.
All right.
And free hamburgs. However, the owner of the club came in a month later and saw the size of the hamburgs I was making for everybody. He said, let's make that $250 a week, but no more free hamburgs.
We got to cut down on that. By the 50s, and I know we're leaping here, but our time is short, you were sitting in 1955 before the House Un-American Activities Committee. You ended up blacklisted along with lots of left-leaning artists of that day and narrowly escaped prison.
Well, I didn't use the Fifth Amendment. I said, I don't think these are questions that any American should be forced to answer, especially under threat of reprisal if they give the wrong answer. So I just clammed up. My lawyer made the defense on the basis of the First Amendment, which basically says you have a right to your own opinion. And the judge didn't agree with my lawyer and sentenced me to a year in jail, but my lawyer got me out on bail, and a year later, the appeals court acquitted me, saying, they covered themselves and said, we are not inclined to lightly disregard charges of unconstitutionality, even though they may be made by those unworthy of our respect.
And so Pete Seeger sailed free. We're going to come back and talk about Pete Seeger and the 60s and how they reflect on our moment in time today. Let's go into the break listening to Wasn't That a Time? I'm Tom Ashbrook with Pete Seeger. This is On Point.
The madmen come, and shall our victory fail? There is no victory in our land where free men go to jail. Isn't this a time? Isn't this a time? A time to try? The soul of man, this terrible time. Our faith cries out, they shall not pass. We cry, no passer on, we pledge our lives, our honor all free. Our native land, isn't this a time? Isn't this a time? The soul of man, this a wonderful life. Isn't this a time? Isn't this a time? A time to pray. The soul of man, this a wonderful life. Isn't this so wonderful time?
From Boston.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Pete Seeger. This is another Pete Seeger classic, To Everyone in All the World.
To everyone in all the world, I reach my hand, I shake their hand. To everyone in all the world, I shake their hands like this. All together, the whole wide world around. I may not know your lingo, but I can say by jingo. No matter where you live, we can shake hands. All together, the whole wide world around. I may not know your lingo, but I can say by jingo. No matter where you live, we can shake hands.
Pete Seeger singing To Everyone in All the World, and you hear that classic Pete Seeger sound that makes you want to hold the hand of the person next to you and sing out at the refrain. Pete Seeger, it's always great. In the 60s, you really became an icon, even though you were not a child of the 60s by any means. What was it that so caught fire? What was the germ you brought forward from the 30s and the 40s that just captured that imagination and record albums in the 60s?
Well, I've always loved to sing for kids. I started in 1968 or 38 or 39, mm-hmm. and I still sing for schools. You can't say there's no hope when you look at all those little faces. And that was actually a children's song. But I think grown-up songs can also use a little bit of that same spirit of join in, have some fun. And I purposely made this song about Dr. King, a song you can dance to. A lot of peace songs are slow and thoughtful,
yeah.
but decided to make this one something that a jazz trumpeter could enjoy playing.
And a 10-year-old could jitter around and have a lot of fun. Here we are. We're years on now from the 60s. Another war potentially looms. I read that one of the things that you tell American children when you speak with them today is do not trust the media. I want to understand that.
Well, you know what? You have to read between the lines no matter what you're reading.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a bad habit that the media has to give us the bad news. In mm-hmm. newspapers, they say, if it doesn't bleed, it doesn't lead. And I would like to see some of the good stories told. There are more good stories going on in America today, I believe, than ever in history. Have you ever told the story of Granny D?
Tell us.
A woman 90 years old who walked from Los Angeles to Washington with a banner saying, election campaign reform.
That's a long walk.
She walked 10 miles a day. It took her 14 months, but she did it. And she had a laptop. When she got near Washington, she tapped out a little note saying, and sent it to several thousand people. She'd kept their names and addresses. If you want to join me the last 5 miles, be at the Arlington Cemetery next Thursday at 9 a.m. 2,200 people showed up. She gave them a short speech. These men died for our democracy. And what's happening in Washington? You can't get elected unless you raise millions of dollars. And they walked across the Potomac down to the Capitol, and she stood on the steps of the Capitol saying, these houses of Congress are being turned into houses of prostitution. She's a great person, Granny D. She's 92 now.
And there's your shining story and your sharp lick all at the same time. Pete Seeger, what is it that you want young Americans today to know about the history, the roots, the sentiments and outlook that Americans have had in decades before them, going back even to your youth? Are there things that are the signals that are weak today that they need to be reminded of, that they need to feel again? There's a kind of clarity and clearness and almost purity in a lot of the songs you sing.
I believe that people working together in groups. I believe in small business, small churches, small unions even, and small scientific groups and small cultural groups. We have a little club in my hometown called the Beacon Sloop Club, which helps the Sloop Clearwater clean up the Hudson River. And every June, we have the world's best strawberry shortcake festival.
And it doesn't take a big group to make a strawberry shortcake. Are we getting back to that? People talk about technology and the Internet allowing smaller congregations of people again.
Listen, do you know, I've got something you should remember. This world is going to be saved by technology saving the world before big technology wipes it out. It'll be small technology which saves it when big technology often doesn't know what to do and does the wrong thing.
We can hope for that. And when you sit with children today, do you get that same feeling of hope? Do they have the same get up and go that you've always seen?
I wish you could hear. I've heard the third graders in my hometown sing Take It From Dr. King last spring. It was beautiful. In fact, they were dancing while they did it.
How's your banjo picking these days at 84, Pete Seeger?
Oh, it's slowed down. I listened to things I used to play 25 years ago and said, how the heck did I play it that fast? But I still like to pick a banjo.
And do you still have the same inscription on that banjo?
This machine surrounds hate and forces it to surrender. I hope.
We hope. We all hope. Pete Seeger, it's just been terrific talking with you tonight. And thank you for your new song, Take It From Dr. King. Thank you for being there. And thank you for all the songs I had around the campfire and thousands of our listeners have as well. We are grateful to you and always will be.
Thank you, Tom. Bye.
Bye. Thanks for joining us, Pete Seeger. As we say goodbye, let's listen to a little more of Pete Seeger's latest song in a long, long line of songs that have become important threads in the American tapestry, Take It from Dr. King.
No more than millions of seas that they were sowing. They were singing on marches, even singing in jail. Songs gave them courage to believe they would not fail.
Listeners, what has Pete Seeger's impact been on America's political, social, and cultural landscape? Get into the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, but first, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
Our capital system is haunted by the demon of error. Error in determining guilt, error in determining who among the guilty deserves to die. Because of all of these reasons, today, I'm commuting the sentence of all death row inmates. 167 of them.
I am ready to announce today that I am a candidate for President of the United States in 2004. And I intend to win.
When Mr. El Baradei and Blix go to Iraq next week, they will press for the gaps to be filled in. They will press for Iraq to be more proactive in its cooperation. And they will do whatever needs to be done for them to fulfill their mandate.
Time is running out on Saddam Hussein. He must disarm. I'm sick and tired of games and deception.
DCO was someone I've met when he worked with my security team on visits to the Northwest. His family has lost a very fine man. The community has lost a very fine police officer. Someone whose death we mourn and whose death should redouble our determination to tackle terrorism in all its forms.
And we hope that the U.S. government will admit the contributing factors and pledge to them. One, we'll try to compensate you. It can't bring them back, but we want to try to make things right. And two, we will fix the problems that led to this so that hopefully it doesn't happen again.
The people and rulers of Baghdad have resolved to compel the Mongols of this age to commit suicide on its walls and make the confrontation. In terms of meaning and sacrifice, to rise to a level which could lead other eyes and minds to be wide open.
And there is a week. Illinois Governor George Ryan commuting the death sentences of every Illinois death row inmate. Connecticut Senator Joe Lieberman declaring his candidacy for the 2004 presidential race. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan saying that talk of war with Iraq is premature. President Bush making clear that he's losing patience with Saddam's games and deception. Britain's Prime Minister Tony Blair expressing remorse over the murder of an anti-terrorism officer in Manchester, England. Attorney David Beck arguing that his client, Illinois Air National Guard Major William Umbach, should not face criminal charges for the friendly fire deaths of four Canadian soldiers last year in Kandahar. And a defiant Iraqi president, Saddam Hussein, speaking today, he vowed to defeat U.S. troops at the gates of Baghdad. Jack Beatty, Iraq doesn't go away. North Korea keeps coming. It's a world of conflict waiting to happen out there. Let's hope it doesn't. But what do we got?
I think as the contour of events becomes clear, it's clearer and clearer that these two crises, North Korea and Iraq, are working in a kind of scissors. And George Bush is in the middle. He is clearly going to have to do some sort of appeasement of North Korea. He's already being criticized by former Clinton officials for that and for weakening deterrence with North Korea. But it looks as if there's no other way to go, and already they've been softening their line. Now, this, of course, raises exponentially the chances of war against Saddam, because the president cannot afford to have his preemptive strike idea breached twice. And he's got to be afraid now that the signals he's sending North Korea, which is you can basically blackmail the U.S., that this is being misinterpreted in Baghdad. And so I think this raises the possibility even of unilateral war, because last week Mr. Bush's approval rating sunk below 60% for the first time since September 11th, and the only sure way in the short term to revive that is, I'm afraid, a military engagement. Students of military history will recognize his dilemma. He's like the Kaiser on August 1st, 1914, when he set the troops in motion toward France, set them in motion toward Russia. Had a second thought about France. No, let's recall them and send them to Russia, he said to his foreign minister. And the guy broke down and wept. He said, you can't do that. The deployments have to take place, the railroad timetables and so on. Well, for Mr. Bush, his deployment may be driving his policy.
You almost get the sense this week with his sick and tired comment that there may be a bit of hurry up in the fight with Iraq to hopefully, he may hope, clear the decks for Pyongyang.
Well, yes, and a hurry up because of the approaching, the idea of keeping an expeditionary force over there through the summer, just sitting there, that's not going to help him in the polls, even if, as I think very plausible, he could say it's helping to disarm Iraq because the inspections kept going. And the other thing about the North Korea crisis is that, Dick Cheney can say, hey, look at this guy, the North Korean dictator, is keeping South Korea in pawn but with his nuclear saber rattling. Same thing could happen if Saddam gets the bomb.
At the same time, from Turkey, France, the Mideast, UN, even to some extent the UK, we're not hearing enthusiasm for this fight. In fact, it's the opposite. Everybody practically saying, wait for the sanction of the UN Security Council, which does not look like it's about to pop out of the toaster here.
No, it doesn't, and yet I have the feeling you can always count on Saddam for some politically irrational move that could tip this thing. Someone wrote the other day that there may be a regime change in London if this war goes forward on a unilateral U.S.-British basis. All kinds of changes could come out of this war. Let's just hope that the inspectors can get better cooperation, get the scientists out, and that it's clear to the world that progress is being made, even if it's not clear to Mr. Bush.
Meanwhile, the troop levels mount and mount, and they cannot sit there forever. Jack, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Amata, Tamar Morad, Virginia Prescott, Sky Rode, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Todd Brubaker and John Perotti. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.